It's Friday, July 31st. We knew there would be lots to argue about on Election Day. We didn't know the actual day of the election would be one of them. We start here. As a former president remembers John Lewis by extolling the power of the vote,
there are those in power who are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting.
President Trump cast doubt on election results before a single vote has been cast. Rent is coming due, whether people have the money or not.
We're literally just trying to sell every single thing that we have in the bar.
As the pandemic results in more shutdowns, how are small businesses supposed to escape from under a mountain of bills? And the NBA is back, taking a stand on justice, but what's fair about this?
Coaches were reporting instances of Chinese coaches physically abusing the young players.
ESPN's jaw-dropping investigation into how tomorrow's players are being molded in China. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. We began the week by telling you about the celebration of John Lewis, the civil rights leader and congressman. His remains traveled to Selma, Alabama, to Washington. Well, yesterday, that procession ended with his funeral in Atlanta.
Take my hand.
And while this was a somber moment, it also came with an impassioned message. Because remember, John Lewis will always be remembered for being a champion of the Voting Rights Act. There have actually been calls to rename the landmark law after him. And so yesterday, as speaker after speaker eulogized Lewis, the through line of these services was all about the power of the vote.
To really give meaning to the John we love, vote.
But in a solemn moment, he pulled me closer and he whispered, "Everyone has to vote in November."
And that reached a crescendo as former President Barack Obama took the mic.
"We may no longer have to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar in order to cast a ballot. But even as we sit here, there are those in power who are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting."
And coincidentally or not, this all came on the same day that the current president of the United States, Donald Trump, attempted to sow seeds of doubt about the American election. I want to start the show with the co-anchor of Nightline, ABC's Byron Pitts. Hey, Byron, first of all, can you walk me through this funeral service? Because it seemed almost like something that was more political than something you might expect from a funeral or from a former president.
Sure. I mean, certainly I think for the uninitiated, what part of what we saw in John Lewis's funeral is part of the black church tradition.
"I would like to use as a subject from which to preach this morning."
If you think back to Dr. King, he called it the social gospel. Many of his speeches that he gave that were very political, very activist speeches, were done in pulpits.
"We have difficult days ahead in the struggle for justice and peace, but I will not yield to a politic of despair."
Having grown up in the black church, I can't count the number of times, whether it was election season or some issue in the community, where the preacher or the politician or the local attorney or the local community activist would speak from the pulpit, use scripture, use that rhythmic speech of the minister, the black preacher, and the speech be political.
"George Wallace may be gone, but we can witness our federal government sending agents to use tear gas and batons against peaceful demonstrators."
Barack Obama, who we heard a number of times when he was president, sometimes at funerals, in black churches, in different kinds of settings, where he went there, if you will.
"And attacking our voting rights with surgical precision, even undermining the Postal Service in the run-up to an election."
It wasn't a coincidence he talked about the postal issue as relates to voting.
"We all agree that absentee voting is good. Mail-in ballots will lead to the greatest fraud."
President Trump was not at John Lewis's funeral, but he was very much inside the room. And John Lewis, who was no fan of President Trump and his service and what he stood for, stands in direct contrast to much of what President Trump stands for and much of how he sees the November election and how it should go.
"Once we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we should keep marching to make it even better."
Yeah, it did almost seem like President Obama rejoining the political world in a way we have not seen from him very often. But let's talk about President Trump, because as you mentioned, Byron, at the White House, President Trump was tweeting sort of doubts about mail-in ballots. He also proposed something he said he wouldn't even have considered back in April. He openly has now pondered moving the date of the election. I mean, first of all, is that something he can do?
Well, based on all the checking that we've done, the short answer is no, he can't.
Neither the Constitution nor federal law gives the president any power to change the election or to extend his term.
It would have to involve Congress. And Republicans made clear.
Never in the history of the country, through wars, depressions, and the Civil War, have we ever not had a federally scheduled election on time.
I just feel I don't want to delay. I want to have the election. But I also don't want to have to wait for 3 months and then find out that the ballots are all missing and the election doesn't mean anything.
Well, and the president's raised doubts not just about the date of the election, but really the outcome of the election, because he's basically saying voting by mail, in which everyone in a state or an area gets a ballot and then returns it, or they can go to the polls in person if they want, will result in a less legitimate election, which experts who study this just say that it is not true. So as you watched this play out yesterday, where are we with voting in America?
It spoke to the divide in America. Certainly there is a racial divide there's been lots of coverage about, but there's also a tremendous and deep and painful and bitter political divide. At the funeral of John Lewis in Atlanta, this was a man who devoted his adult life to equality, certainly, but in particular, the right to vote. He bled for it.
17 of us were hospitalized that day, but we never became bitter or hostile. We kept believing that the truth we stood for would have the final say.
And then the president's talking about changing the process and raising concerns about it not being legitimate.
You're sending out hundreds of millions of universal mail-in ballots. Hundreds of millions. Where are they going? Who are they being sent to? It's common sense. You don't have to know anything about politics.
And ultimately, the bottom line is wanting to reduce the number of people who might vote. I mean, the reality is, in this age of a pandemic, mail-in ballots is the way many states will likely go for health reasons, for safety reasons, because it may well be too dangerous for American citizens to gather in high school gymnasiums and auditoriums in large groups to vote. So taking the politics out of it, there is a medical health argument for why mail-in ballots may be so vital to this year's election, no matter what President Trump wants.
And I think it's important to clarify, the president said there will be a delay in votes being tallied. That is most likely true with all the votes coming through the mail. What is not necessarily true is that the count of those votes won't be accurate. Some big moments to watch. Byron Pitts, thank you.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Next up on Start Here, that extra unemployment money people have been getting goes away today. So what do you do if you're still falling behind on rent? More after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Coronavirus cases are still surging in several states, but as a nation right now, it looks as if they have leveled off. Remember that plateau we saw back in April? Well, they've plateaued again, just this time at a much higher number. More than 60,000 Americans continue to be infected each day. A big reason for the leveling off, of course, are cities and states mandating masks, restricting big gatherings, big actions, which, as we all know by now, leads to layoffs.
The Labor Department said another 1.4 million Americans filed new claims last week for unemployment benefits.
Well, remember, today is the day that this big added benefit to people on unemployment was supposed to end. Congress has not passed a replacement bill for this. It's just not a good look, as Congress all got set to leave for the weekend on a Thursday afternoon. So Republican senators scrambled a vote.
Congress is at a complete stalemate here. If anything, talks are going backwards, not forwards.
But that deal is not done. And across the country, rent is due tonight for lots of folks in apartments, houses, whether you're laid off or not. And let's not forget, people who own shut down businesses as well. They pay rent too, and in a lot of cases, they're still being told by their landlords, you owe us. I'm going to talk to one of those business owners right now. Natasha David owns a bar in Manhattan's Lower East Side, usually bustling. That neighborhood has not been that way for months. Natasha, your bar is called Nightcat. Can you tell me what it's been like there?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of Nightcat started probably about 8 years ago. We've been open for about six, so... You know, the idea was to create a welcoming and open-minded little cocktail bar in New York City, because at the time, cocktail bars were very, everyone had a beard and everyone wore ties and vests. It was, it was exclusive and it was very much a business focused on white males, and those were kind of the stars. So I wanted to break the mold a little bit. I've been working in the service industry since I was 18, and I was approached by my two current business partners, and they were like, hey, do you want to open a bar with us? And I sort of very naively said, okay, and here we are today.
Well, okay, so how has life changed over the last few months?
The business was in a really good place. After 6 years, the business was profitable. The week that we got shut down, we had... planned to close the bar for one day to completely repaint, and we had bought all these new bar stools, and we were doing this big revamp because we finally were doing pretty well. And then COVID happened. And here we are, 5 months down the road. You know, during those 5 months, obviously there's rent, okay? But there's also general liability insurance. There's an ice machine that you have a 10-year contract with that you have to pay even though you're closed. Mm. There is a dishwasher that you rent that you also have a contract with. There's workers' comp insurance. It's just like the list goes on and on and on. And these things just pile up, and you keep paying them. And you kind of keep paying them because you're holding on to this hope that, oh, this is going to end soon. Let's just hold on for one more month. We can do this for one more month, and by then, things will have calmed down and we'll be able to open again.
And the bills keep arriving.
There comes a point where, as a small business, you can't just keep accumulating this debt, hoping that somebody's going to step in. So to try to renegotiate my lease, which is something that we want to do, is we want to renegotiate our lease. We've hired lawyers, and we need lawyers to both help us renegotiate our lease, which is what I'm hoping will happen, right?
or to get out of our lease.
Oh, so forget the rent. Like, now you're talking about paying a lawyer to just deal with the future rent. How do you swing that?
So what we're doing now, kind of as a last act of sort of desperation, is we're literally just trying to sell every single thing that we have in the bar, every single bottle, last bottle of booze.
Wow.
Just to get money into our bank account so that we can cover bills.
Well, Natasha, what I don't get is, you know, because landlords do often owe money to somebody else, right? Whether it's, you know, the mortgage on their own home, or, you know, they got a business that they run, they have employees they need to pay. What I don't get is, your space is built to be essentially a bar. A restaurant is built to be a restaurant. It takes lots to change that. I can't imagine that a landlord could kick you out, entice a new owner to come in, and somehow make a super profitable bar in all these circumstances. Like, who do they expect to be able to actually pay if you can't pay?
That's another thing, right? You would think that landlords wouldn't be so short-sighted. Who in their right mind right now is going to open a new bar and restaurant and pay the same amount of rent that they were paying before, or that the space was asking for before, when they can't seat as many people? You know, I don't pay my rent on a Monday night when it's like a few neighborhood regulars like taking their time over two cocktails in 3 hours. I pay my rent on Saturdays when like my server cannot walk through the bar with a tray because it is so packed. Like, that is how I pay my bills. Right now, my legal capacity in real life, not COVID life, is 65 people, okay? With the 6-foot distancing rule and, you know, barricades and all this, and the line to the, you know, to the bathroom, I'd have to block this off and that off and all these things. I'm not kidding when I say at most I can have about 15 people at my bar. It's so short-sighted. Work with the tenants that you have in your building and make sure that they thrive and are successful so that you can continue whatever you need to do. It's just absurd.
Well, so realistically, I mean, when do you have to have this sorted out by? Like, what is the plan?
The plan, there is no plan. There hasn't been a plan. There isn't a plan because there's no way to really have a plan. I think right now I still have a little bit of that fighting spirit in me. But I don't know, ask me in 3 months.
Right.
Might be a very different story.
All right, Natasha David, selling bottles, selling inventory, selling sticks of furniture for these lawyer bills that are now in play as well. Natasha, good luck. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Brad.
Last night, in its Orlando bubble, the NBA restarted its season.
First touch, Zion Williamson, it goes, and one.
In that game, and in more games to follow today, the league is taking emphatic stands about racial justice, social change, human rights.
So you saw players, coaches, game officials alike, all taking a knee in Orlando.
But right as those first teams were getting ready to tip off, our partners at ESPN broke a huge story about the NBA. Not a story here in the States, but in China. And that story is raising questions about how truly committed the NBA is to human rights when it involves one of the most lucrative markets in the world. ESPN's Mark Fanaruwada led this investigation. You might remember he has broken stories about steroids in baseball, doping programs in the Olympics. He joins us now. Mark, thanks for being with us. What happened here?
You know, along with my brother and colleague, Steve, we started back in October of last year when Daryl Morey, the general manager of the Houston Rockets, tweeted what's, you know, didn't seem to be that controversial a post in support of Hong Kong protesters.
It all started with this tweet from Houston Rockets GM Daryl Morey. Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong.
This firestorm cost the NBA millions of dollars.
Breaking news, China announcing this morning they're pulling NBA games from their airways.
It's my hope that for our Chinese fans and our partners in China, they will see those remarks in the context of now a 3-decade, if not longer, relationship.
And so at that point, my brother and I decided we really wanted to look into the NBA's presence in China and extend the sort of conversation around this. So we started looking into these NBA training academies, including the one in Xinjiang, to try and find out what was going on there and what the relationships were like and what the partnerships were like.
Tell me about these training camps, because in the States, you go to high school, you go to college, that's where you learn basketball. That's not how it is in a lot of the world.
No, what the NBA was dealing with in China was, in a lot of cases, they're identifying players at a very young age and basically putting them in sports bureaus and deciding that they're going to try to focus them on developing them into these super athletes who maybe will represent the team, the country in the Olympics, or ultimately become professional basketball players.
Yao takes it up and in. 35 for Yao Ming.
And so the league, as it's tried to expand its presence in China, created these NBA training academies and basically tried to train some of the most elite players, or what they thought were some of the most elite players in the country.
There's no doubt that there are several more NBA players that will come out of China. We're seeing that now.
One of the things that the NBA, they later said to us, was there was a little level of naivete for them, as how they described it, that they were really partnering with these Chinese coaches and Chinese sports bureaus. And what they found was coaches were reporting instances of Chinese coaches physically abusing the young players. Mm. And the NBA coaches were aghast at it, reported it to their bosses, and complained that it was a regular occurrence at the three academies. This was problematic.
What we have are these things called NBA basketball schools, and that's for kind of an after-school tuition-based program.
The other thing is that when the NBA announced these academies, Commissioner Adam Silver, in announcing them, had said education would be a primary part of this. This would be a holistic approach to sports, and that the athletes would be trained not only in basketball, but they would take academic courses, and that would be all pushed. And I think the league's position is now they thought that's what was happening. But in fact, our reporting shows that the kids were not in school. You had them training 2 to 3 times a day and then virtually unsupervised at times when they were not training.
The UN and rights groups say a million or more Uyghurs are held in massive internment camps in Xinjiang in dire conditions.
They would tell us that we were poisoned by religion, that Islam is an infectious disease.
And you mentioned like this region in Western China earlier. It's interesting that in addition to Hong Kong, arguably the bigger human rights issue that's unfolding in China right now is there in Western China with that Muslim minority group, the Uyghurs. And what, the NBA has a camp that's essentially right in the middle of that region. How did that play into it?
Well, it's really interesting. When the league said that they were creating these three academies and launching the three academies, they placed this one in the middle of this area in Xinjiang.
China's Xinjiang Flying Tigers is going up against the Philippines.
It is an area that where basketball is fairly successful, partly because the Uyghurs oftentimes are at least what we were told, there are some better athletes, there are larger, taller players. And the NBA was dealing with not only coaches complaining about the repression of Uyghurs there.
Is there torture?
Yes.
What kind?
Physical torture. All of the people who are being detained in these facilities are being subjected to degradation and humiliation of a kind that would break just about anyone.
But also their own coaches being detained and harassed while they were in Xinjiang.
Well, and so at the end of the day, I mean, the question the NBA is going to have to answer is, who knew about these conditions with these kids, essentially, with young people in these camps? And I mean, who takes responsibility for that? What's the NBA telling you?
Well, I think that the two most interesting things, we had a long conversation with Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum of the NBA, who oversees international operations for the league. And I thought the two most interesting things that came out of that conversation were his suggestion that the league offices, at least in New York, did not know a lot about the things that we were revealing. He said, you know, it was their belief and understanding the kids were in school. They were only aware of a couple of incidents in which there were allegations of physical abuse, despite the coaches telling us that this was virtually systemic. So I thought that's where the league is on this, that they're suggesting that not only did the commissioner not know, but it really hadn't moved up to New York. The other thing I thought that and he's getting condemned now for this fairly widely, is when we pressed Deputy Commissioner Tatum on why they left Xinjiang finally after so much, you know, condemnation about what was happening to the Uyghurs there, we asked and pressed repeatedly whether human rights conditions had any relation to that move, and he really dodged the question. He avoided it like crazy and just ultimately said there were many factors, and then said, you know, we're basically, it's not our role to police human rights violations around the world, which, of course, given their position on social justice in the States, has created a level of argument that there's a real hypocrisy there for the league.
Yeah, we'll see whether these claims kind of loom over this moment as the NBA season begins. We reached out to the NBA ourselves, and Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum told us, quote, the allegations in the ESPN article are disturbing, end quote. He said they've been reevaluating the NBA Academy program in China and pointed out that coaches sent by the NBA have not been accused of any wrongdoing. Mark Fanaruwada, who, along with his brother, incredible reporting for ESPN. Thanks so much, Mark.
My pleasure, Brad. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And one last thing. Remember, even as America's coronavirus nightmare continues, a lot of Europe is actually getting back to normal-ish. People can travel unless you're from the U.S. We are banned from entering European countries, except a few.
But Croatia broke ranks. They decided to allow American tourists in.
That is ABC's foreign correspondent Maggie Ruley, who told us places like Croatia have become these weird neutral zones for Americans and people who want to meet up with Americans, whether they're from there or not.
Yeah, well, Brad, get this. So all of a sudden, when a country opens up its borders, when other countries are closing them down, we've noticed that it's sort of become a dating hotspot.
Yeah, you heard that right. You know, when you live across town from your new significant other and there's this convenient restaurant just halfway between you, that is what Croatia has become to a lot of couples. So Maggie tagged along with them.
We went on this date with this one couple. We crashed their date, their romantic getaway, and ABC News was there. And neither of them are Croatian.
The girl is American. The guy is British. He lives in the Czech Republic, which will not accept Americans unless they've got special status. And this actually raises a serious issue for people trapped on opposite sides of a border.
We've heard from a lot of couples right now that, Brad, they haven't been able to see each other in months.
A lot of these travel rules went into effect so quickly, long-term partners had no way to get their lives ironed out. We've seen couples sitting at border crossings together just to see each other in person. Of course, countries like Croatia are in a tricky spot themselves. They want tourists back, it's how they make money, but the more tourists, the more risks. Which is why these two lovebirds got tests before and after their trip. It also gave an excuse to keep Maggie and her crew 6 feet away from them on their date. ABC stands for Always Be Crashing Those Dates. Third Wheel Ruley. Start Here is produced by David Rhine, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Trevor Hastings, Susie Liu, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Mariam Khan, Ali Pekhorin, Liz Alessi, Van Scott, Smitha Shashadri, Chris Berry, Josh Margolin, and Cindy Galley. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.